Because you get that legend is a phrase bandied around sport far too easily. Because you get that politics is more about what's possible. Because you get that a cryptic clue can have a simple solution. Because you get the benefit of hearing other opinions. The Irish Times. Because you get it. Enjoy unlimited access to informed opinion and real news. Visit irishtimes.com and get the first month for just €1. T's and C's apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
August the 2nd, 1982. On a sun-splattered day in August 40 years ago, a clean-shaven and well-dressed man cycled down Georgia Street, Dunlira, on a red racing bike. He dismounted near the shopping centre on the main street. He then walked over to the local newsstands and stood there for some time, staring at the young man selling newspapers at the stand. The young man's name was John Monks.
I was standing outside the shopping centre and I just seen him coming down the road from Docky direction on a red racing bike, and he got off the bicycle. He just walked up as close as I am to you. He just stared at me. I stared at him. There was nothing said. He just walked away. You know, I got a bit worried, so I walked away.
What was your impression?
I was sure it was this bloke, you know, that the descriptions had been given on television. So I said, it must be him, you know.
It was all very strange and disconcerting. To John Monks, it seemed like an unofficial identity parade. The man was obviously checking to see if Monks recognised him. He did recognise him. In mid-July, the man had come to his newsstands almost every day, but had then stopped coming. There was one difference. Now, the man was clean-shaven. Then, he wore a beard. The man, of course, was Malcolm MacArthur. Monks did not know it at the time, but this peculiar encounter would become a key turning point in the hunt for the man who killed two young people earlier that summer. I'm Harry McGee of the Irish Times, and this is episode 4 of Gooboo, a 7-part series looking at one of the most infamous murder cases in Ireland and how it almost toppled the government of Charles J. Haughey 40 years ago.
It wasn't called Watergate in the Irish context, it was called Gooboo.
Gooboo, famous words, grotesque, unprecedented, bizarre and unbelievable.
It was grotesque, it was unbelievable, it was bizarre, it was unprecedented.
It was a Gooboo situation and Haughey was right in the middle of it.
People, you know, saw all kind of conspiracies during that 81, 82. It was crazy stuff. I mean, the place became a bit crazy for a year or two.
Dunlira is a coastal town south of Dublin. In the 80s, it was a mixum gathering place, partly well-to-do, partly gritty. It had a large port. Ferries arrived from England and from France, hundreds of cars and thousands of passengers disgorged onto the quay. On sunny days, the seafront was also thronged with people.
Dunlira was buzzing, absolutely buzzing. I'm in the town now since I'm 8 years of age, nearly 6 years, and it's a ghost town now compared to what it was.
This is George Davis. He's from Dunlira. He left school at 13 and started selling newspapers on the street. He describes the town as it was in the early 1980s.
I remember as a kid, the boat would come in at 5:30. All the old people used to have to walk from the boat up to the railway station. We carried our bags, we'd get a few bob. You're always kind of doing something to get a few bob in them days. So the town was absolutely buzzing. You couldn't move on the streets of Dunleary. On a Saturday, everyone went to Dunleary. That was the highlight of the week for all the young people. That all went Dunleary to shop and the whole lot.
In 1982, George Davis was running a small business selling newspapers on the street. John Monks was one of his employees. We will hear more about his role a little later on. By early August, Gordy had established that the same suspect was responsible for two murders, that of Bridie Gargan on the 22nd of July and that of Donald Dunn on the 25th of July. For the first week of the investigation, they had focused on the north side of Dublin. MacArthur had taken a bus to Finglas. He'd also been spotted in two clay pigeon clubs north of the city. But John Monk's eyewitness account would shift everything to the south of the city. In fact, Malcolm MacArthur had been in Dunleary since the 8th of July. Earlier that summer, in May, he, his partner Brenda Little, and their young son had moved thousands of kilometres away to Tenerife in the Canary Islands, with a view to living there. Then, abruptly, in early July, he told his partner he needed to go to Switzerland to sort out his financial affairs. He never went there. Instead, he flew straight back to Ireland and booked into a guest house in Dunleary. What he had not told Little was that he was broke and in desperate need of money. While in Tenerife, he had read newspaper accounts of a series of armed robberies carried out by the Provisional IRA in Ireland. This is John O'Mahony, one of the detectives who worked on that murder hunt.
He ran out of money, having a lifestyle, playboy lifestyle, the Riviera and Italy and places like that. Money had run out. I need money. Where am I going to get money? A lot of robberies at the time, armed robberies. Provo is doing robberies. So I need a gun.
That was his plan. Get a car, get a gun, stick people up. He wanted to conduct, as he put it, a calculated, cold-hearted operation to raise funds. Malcolm MacArthur arrived in Dunleary a fortnight before his attack on Bridie Gargan. He chose the seaside town deliberately. It was at a remove from his usual haunts in Dublin city centre. He did not want to bump into any of his acquaintances. He began growing a beard and wearing glasses that he obviously did not need, as he had to constantly peer over the top of his rims. He clearly didn't follow the advice of the anarchist in G.K. Chesterton's novel, The Man Who Was Thursday. If you don't seem to be hiding, nobody hunts you out. His unusual get-up and his odd manner were noticed. In his first 10 days in the seaside town, he visited the newsstands operated by John Monks each day. He bought a copy of the Irish Times. He would also read the classified advertisements in the evening press and buy it if there was something he spotted. He was obviously planning his cold-hearted operation. During that time, he also opened up an account in a nearby bank under a false name, John Eustace.
At that time, there was ads about guns for sale. So what he was reading, he'd read the ads on the Evening Press and the Evening Herald. He had the Times in the morning, and then that's another, I suppose, link, because not too many people would have been, and that we would be following as suspects, would have been in reading the Irish Times. That maybe we should have been following some of them.
In that two-week period, he travelled into the city to make some key purchases for his plan. The murder squad detective, Tony Hickey, explains what they were.
He had bought the hammer and the shovel in Linhens and Capel Street, and that was all traced back through the till and the date and everything else. And he had bought a crossbow in Gannett and Keegan, at that time were in Parnell Street. He had refashioned the firing mechanism with paint, I think, and it was a replica, but it looked like a real pistol.
Linhens is a hardware shop in Dublin city centre that's still in business. Garnet and Keegan was a fishing tackle and gun shop nearby. It's no longer there. MacArthur also visited the clay pigeon clubs during this time. He carried all those implements with him when he started his murderous spree on the 22nd of July, attacking Bridie Gargan in the Phoenix Park. 3 days later, as we have heard, Donald Dunn lost his life on a firing range outside Edenderry in County Offaly.
The buyer, who I think fired a shot at the target and then obviously shot Donald Dunn, and a horrible, horrible case, callous, terrible, terrible case, took the car and headed for Dublin and abandoned near the Central Bank.
After walking away from the car on that Sunday, MacArthur went to ground. He lay low in Dunlira for several days. There were blood flecks on his shirt and trousers. He threw them into the sea. He did the same with the imitation firearm. Immediately upon returning to Dunlira, he went to a public call box and phoned his partner Brenda Little in Tenerife. He told her he was in Ostend in Belgium, sorting out finances. He assured her he would return to the Canary Islands within a week. But towards the end of the week, Little had not heard back from him. She rang her good friend Patrick Connolly on Saturday the 31st of July to ask him had he seen Malcolm. Connolly kept a diary throughout his life. His nephew Stephen recalls an entry he made in July that year.
There's an entry in his diary on the 31st of July, and he said that he'd received a call from Brenda, very worried. Malcolm MacArthur had told her that he was in Europe settling certain financial matters. Again, there's an element of fantasy to his entire life. I mean, and Paddy mentioned this on the Sunday. I said, I'm very concerned Malcolm MacArthur. And you know, myself, my father, Paddy, it's, yeah, so what?
What MacArthur was actually up to that weekend was his first ham-fisted attempt at an armed robbery. After all, he had now finally acquired his gun. In 1992, as a young journalist, I wrote about the case on its 10th anniversary. Someone who had encountered MacArthur in those days told me about this incident on that Saturday. MacArthur arrived at the home of an acquaintance in Fitzwilliam Square in Dublin city centre, close to where he had himself lived. He was wearing rubber gloves, which he said he needed to wear because he had dermatitis. He also carried the blue hold-all bag, which probably contained a shotgun. It just so happened that the elderly owner of the house was not alone. His son and daughter-in-law had joined him, and they invited MacArthur to stay for dinner. He removed the gloves and talked knowledgeably about the preservation of Georgian buildings in the area. His hosts could not see any sign of a rash or dermatitis on his hands. He left the house at 1:30 a.m, still carrying the blue hold-all bag. It was only some weeks later, when everything came out into the open, that these three people realised how close a call it had been and how they had dined with a double killer about to commit his next crime.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
July turned into August. Malcolm MacArthur was becoming increasingly desperate. He was running out of money. It was also likely that he felt vulnerable in Dunlira and worried about getting caught. His fears were well-founded. This is how the Gordie came to learn of what John Monks had seen. That week, a reenactment of the murders was shown on a programme called Gore the Patrol on RTE.
Gee Eve, and welcome to Garda Patrol.
To my knowledge, it was the first reenactment that had actually been done with RTE. There was a detective who had a beard and looked something like the suspect, and he was dressed up in a fisherman's hat and he walked along by the Phoenix Park. That was broadcast on the news, and the following day, a paper seller had come in to Dunleary Station and said, "I think I met that fella a few times. Myself and Frank got that job to do."
John Monks had seen the programme and immediately put two and two together. He contacted his boss, George Davis, the newspaper seller, whom we met earlier in this episode. You had a newspaper stand. It was just outside the shopping centre in Dunera, wasn't that right?
On the top of Marine Road there. And he was looking at the papers, and John was a bit put off for him, or he saw something. He thought he was seeing something under his coat. He noticed that. And he was very astute. That was one of the biggest cases at the time in the country.
Here is John Monks talking in an interview with RTE back in 1983.
When I saw him first, he was on the process of growing a beard, you know. You know, he looked a bit weird, you know.
The clean-shaven MacArthur had arrived at his newspaper stand on a red racing bike. After walking away from the stand without saying anything, MacArthur stopped and looked back again at Monks.
And he stood at the entrance to the front door in the shopping centre, and he turned around again. And with that, you know, I got a bit worried, so I walked away.
What was your impression?
I was sure it was this bloke, you know, that the descriptions had been given on television. So I said, it must be him, you know.
MacArthur's strange apparition before Monks had been a test to see if his anonymity had been compromised. Perhaps, too, he had seen Gore the Patrol. Monks told George Davis about what had happened. Davis told him to go to the police.
This day or two, he got a bit spooked, and he said to me, like, there's a bit funny about this guy.
And what did you say to him then?
Ring the guards. And John rang the guards, and these two rookies came out at the time, because it turned out to be John O'Mahony.
John O'Mahony was indeed a rookie then, and would not have been privy to some of the finer details of the investigation.
I took the statement, dropped it back into Dunleary on a Friday evening. I went home and got a phone call around 10 o'clock that night that the superintendent wants to see me. And you know the way you just think you're in trouble. Young detective, first case, what did I do wrong? But really what I was around was, in the statement, Monks had described a jumper, which was unusual enough. Now, the one question he wanted me to know is, did I know anything about this jumper? I didn't. As transpired afterwards, as for me transpired, was the jumper was found in the laneway near where the car was abandoned, bloodstained, and some of the key detectives, all right, knew about it, but I didn't know about it. Again, I was told to go on about my business.
This was the beige-coloured military-style jumper that MacArthur had thrown over a fence into a garden when fleeing the scene after abandoning Bridie Gargan near the Phoenix Park. In episode one, Tony Hickey described its significance.
The driver, MacArthur, did a U-turn and drove along the South Circle Road, abandoned the car in the laneway, and discarded his pullover, which was subsequently found in a Garda search, and Bridie Gargan's blood was on it.
Within a day or two, John O'Mahony was called back in to help with handling John Monks. The young newspaper seller had disappeared and Gordy could not find him. He had shut down the newspaper stand one evening, went down to the seafront and did not show up at his flat or at work the next day.
Everybody dressed in T-shirts and shorts and in Dunleary, and he was followed by two people who were, one were dressed in suits, shirts and ties, okay? It's obviously two of our lads. We didn't know this now.
When John O'Mahony said two of our lads, he meant two plainclothes Gordie. So Monks had bolted, one of the key witnesses in the largest police manhunt in the history of the state, could not be found. John O'Mahony and Frank Hand spent 2 days looking for him.
So he'd gone missing, so we went to his flat in Dunleary. That was the first port of call, obviously. We met the girlfriend, and she said, "I don't know what's after happening." She said, "He came in here, he filled a bag, and he's gone." Would you believe this? My sister She had a flat in the same house. We took up duty in my sister's flat, and we heard the footsteps going up the stairs, and we had him at that stage. He panicked. He said, I make a statement to you on Friday. Says the following day I'm followed, and these two look like mafia. That's the way he put it, okay? These two goons look like mafia. That was exactly the wording, you know?
Over the next number of days, the two detectives spent all their time with him, visiting pubs and restaurants to see if they could spot the suspect.
The important issue was that he had seen him with the beard, and then after the murder, he had seen him again in Dunleary.
They trawled every street of the seaside town in the forlorn hope of spotting the suspect.
So we had a van and we had a signal. Then in the evening time, we had a very difficult job bringing him around to various pubs, restaurants, that sort of thing, just to see could he pick up this guy, but there was no sign of him.
There was no sign of him. He had, once again, gone to ground. It's important at this stage to understand MacArthur's state of mind around that time. A lawyer familiar with the case said MacArthur adopted a Nietzschean view of himself as an Übermensch or Superman. The lawyer told me, and I quote, he placed himself above the moral and societal orders and concluded in his own mind that acts which he had committed could be undone simply by wishing them away. It explained how he could sustain a cool, gentlemanly demeanour in the face of such horrid deeds, as if it were a departure from ethics, nothing more. While still in Tenerife, Malcolm MacArthur had subjected himself to some bizarre tests to prove himself capable of a criminal act. To test himself, he walked in and out of hotel lobbies carrying a brick. In his mind, he was quite prepared to kill anybody who got in the way of his plan. He did just that. He murdered Bridie Gorgon simply to get a car. He murdered Donald Dunn simply to get a gun. The Gorda operation had long been stepped up. There were now 50 detectives working on it, with the support of scores of other Gordi. They knew the suspect had killed two people and was liable to kill again, especially because he now had a shotgun. This was an armed and dangerous suspect. Thanks to John Monks, the investigation was now firmly focused on the south side of Dublin. His old boss, George Davis, lost touch with John Monks many years ago, but remains convinced of one thing to this day.
John Monks was the man that solved the case, as far as I'm concerned, you know?
Certainly the fact that Monks could say he saw MacArthur with a beard and without a beard bolstered the belief of the Gordi that he remained in this area. All that was confirmed by a jaw-dropping incident that occurred in the nearby suburb of Killiney. The murder squad detective sergeant, Tony Hickey, happened to be in the incident room in Kevin Street when a call came in from Dunleary Gorda station.
There was an incident of what was called an aggravated burglary, which we weren't aware of at that stage, in Harry Beeling's house. And again, it was a strange one in that he answered a call to the door, and a man whom he didn't recognise, again, general description of MacArthur, said, you know, I have been at parties in your house here. And he didn't recollect him or remember ever seeing him.
This was the Harry Beeling incident. Harry Beeling was a retired American diplomat who had spent most of his career in London. He lived in a house called Camelot on Vico Road in Killiney, with its spectacular views of Dublin Bay. On a summer's day, Vico Road reminded you of Italy's Amalfi Coast. It is exclusive. Mega-rich musicians such as Bono and The Edge from U2, as well as the singer Enya, live there. Beeling was at home on the evening of the 4th of August when he heard a knock on the door. Peter Murta, then security correspondent with the Irish Times, takes up the story.
Harry Beeling was an American man, and he lived in a granite sort of gate lodge type house at the top of Killiney Hill. And I think it was probably initially maybe part of the house that's now lived in by Enya.
MacArthur said, in particular, I remember the view from your window overlooking the bay. And he had a hold all. He said, I have a camera, he said, and I would like to take a photograph at sunset over Dublin Bay. And Beeling invited him in.
He goes to the window and he looks out, and it's very, Beeling notes that it's very misty, so you're not going to get a good photograph today. And MacArthur, I believe, said, well, this is exactly as I remember it, you know. So they wander around the house with MacArthur. In retrospect, you would think making sure that nobody else was there.
Beeling could not remember the man who said he had been at one of his parties 8 years previously. MacArthur began rummaging in his blue hold-all bag, telling Beeling, I hope you have a sense of humour.
Then he produces the gun to Harry Beeling, who's rather shocked, and says, I'm in need of some money.
He demanded £1,000, which Beeling said he didn't have. He then demanded a cheque for £1,000. Again, a bit bizarre for an armed robber to look for a cheque. And again, he mentioned that his brother was somewhere outside. So here is the brother. He didn't go down to Eden Derry because his brother was involved in an accident. And here again, he mentions a non-existent brother.
And they go through this sort of bizarre minuet, almost sort of gentlemanly minuet of sitting down together, and MacArthur has the shotgun across his lap, pointing at poor Mr. Beeling. And they chat about this, that, and the other. And at some stage, they go upstairs.
To the bedroom, he said he had a checkbook in some locker beside the bed. And he looked there, and it wasn't there. And he said, oh, no, it's downstairs. There was a spiral staircase. Beeling knew the geography of his own house.
And as he comes down the stairs to the front door, he seizes the moment, throws the front door open and runs out at a rate of knots and escapes down the road.
And MacArthur, again, hadn't even the nuance to follow him. He left and he called to a nearby house. And again, he said to the woman, there has been an accident on the hill, and I think he mentioned a brother. And she was wise enough, she didn't allow him into the house. And he then flagged down a car. I don't think he was like hitchhiking, he flagged it down, is my recollection. Some few guys either going or coming from a fishing trip. And again, they noticed his kind of odd behavior, and they described wearing some kind of a cape, they thought. And they were so curious, he asked to be dropped at Pilot View.
That address would become very important indeed.
They were so curious that when they dropped him, they stopped for a while, and he didn't go into Pilot View. He went into a nearby housing complex called Harbour Crescent, and they watched there for a while, and he didn't come out. They thought he might have doubled back out. So that was that.
In my conversation with Peter Murta, we also discussed how narrow an escape Harry Beeling had had.
It struck me while reading about Harry Beeling, Peter, that he was a very lucky man. He could
extremely
have, given what Martin MacArthur had done.
Yes, extremely.
If he had not made a dash for it, he might not have survived that particular encounter.
Absolutely, absolutely. He was extremely lucky. My memory of him is that he was a well-spoken man, like MacArthur himself. He was slightly diffident. But I think that MacArthur actually got up, and MacArthur is quite a big-ish man, and motioned to threaten him in any way, I don't think Harry Beeling would have been capable of overpowering him. So yes, he was a lucky man, and as we know, Malcolm MacArthur did shoot Donald Dunn in the face with a shotgun, so he had done it once already.
That evening, Harry Beeling contacted the Gordy and reported that a man with a shotgun had tried to rob him. He was so traumatised by the occurrence that he drank too much alcohol that night. There was a very curious postscript to that chilling encounter. Early the following morning, Beeling's phone rang. He was groggy, but the voice on the other side was unmistakable, with that distinctive cut-glass accent. Beeling could hear Beethoven's Seventh Symphony being played in the background. Hello, this is your friend from yesterday, said the caller. Why did you run? There was a pause. Oh, you must have been scared, said the caller. Silly joke gone sour. He then suggested to Beeling that one of them should contact the Gordy. You do it, Beeling told him. MacArthur agreed and even asked to be allowed to call round the following week. Yes, replied Beeling, clearly alarmed, but telephone first. That was not the end of the astonishing developments that morning. At noon, a man did indeed phone Doki Gorda station and identified himself as a freelance journalist. Tony Hickey describes the strange conversation that ensued.
The day after the episode in Beeling's house in Camelot, he had rang, I think it was Doki station, and he spoke to a sergeant there. And he was trying to suss out, had it been reported? And it had been reported, and the sergeant was aware of what happened. And he said, by the way, he said, I'm the guy that was up in Camelot in Beeling, Mr. Beeling's house. He said it was a practical joke, a prank that went wrong, he said. The sergeant asked him, by the way, what's your name? He said, Malcolm MacArthur. And where are you from? He volunteered. He was born in Gardiner Street, which wasn't right. He was caught in the hop, and the simple question, what's your name? You know, intuition or whatever, comes naturally. And then you had coordination with Eden Derry, Donald Dunn, and now you have Dunleary.
It was just extraordinary. The killer being sought by the Gordie had unwittingly named himself. On the basis of that call, Detective Superintendent Mick Sullivan in Dunleary contacted John Courtney, the murder squad, to say, I think I have your man out here. Gordie immediately began house-to-house inquiries around Gardiner Street in Dublin City Centre to see if anyone knew a Malcolm MacArthur. They also began to check out the name Malcolm MacArthur to see if anything turned up. Tony Hickey, Dennis Donegan, and Detective Inspector Noel Conroy, who himself would later become Gordie Commissioner, travelled to the suburb to interview Beeling to see if the name Malcolm MacArthur meant anything to him.
We were amazed to discover that he didn't know this guy or couldn't recollect him, but in the course of the interview, when he named a particular lady, she had been at all the parties, would probably know who was there. And we met her and we brought her to Dunleary station. We explained to her what was happening and described the guy we were looking for. And without hesitation, she said, oh yes, she said, that's Malcolm MacArthur. Now the next question is, where is he? I don't know. But she named somebody in the south side who probably would know. He was a guy that kind of kept track of people. And he had a number for Malcolm MacArthur. And the number checked out to an apartment in Donnybrook. And who had sublet the apartment was Patrick Connolly.
The same Patrick Connolly who was the Attorney General in Charles Haughey's government. It was not the first time his name had cropped up in the investigation. When the man who had tried to rob Harry Beeling on the 4th of August had got a lift to Doki, he had asked to be left off in pilot view. Now, Tony Hickey was taken aback when he learned that news.
House-to-house inquiries in pilot view on the previous day discovered that the Attorney General lived in a penthouse apartment and that he had what people thought was his nephew staying with him for a few days. And again, he fitted the description.
I mean, the Attorney General of the country caught up in one of the biggest murder investigations of the 90s. That must have been shocking to you to kind of... sensitive as well, given...
I wouldn't say shocking, but it sounded a bit daft, to be quite honest. And you'd be reluctant even in the incident room to say what you were thinking.
And you thought, you know, holy cow, you know, what is going on here? Was all of this connected? Was it anything to do with the Attorney General? I mean, the questions just come at 100 miles an hour.
Everything in one of the biggest murder investigations in the history of the state was now pointing to pilot view and the apartment of Patrick Connolly, the Attorney General and a senior member in the government of Charles J. Haughey. Next time on Gubu, investigators close in on Malcolm MacArthur, but it leads to a political scandal unprecedented in scale. Gubu is an Irish Times audio production. It was written, produced and presented by myself, Harry McGee. The editor of Gubu was Enda O'Dowd. The executive editor and senior producer of audio at the Irish Times is Declan Conlon. Sound mix was by J.J. Vernon. Graphics was by Paul Scott. The title music was by Oracle. We thank the RTE Archives, Reuters, the Jimmy Carter Library, the Ronald Reagan Library, and the Oireachtas TV Archive. For further comprehensive coverage of the Gubu scandal, including articles, notes, photographs and maps, visit irishtimes.com. Also, if you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support future long-term projects, please consider subscribing at irishtimes.com/subscribe.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.